Hey, Small Town fam, it's Yardley. I want to remind you that if you want access to bonus episodes and regular episodes a day early and ad-free, and our community forum and other behind-the-scenes goodies, you got to go to smalltowndicks.com/superfam, and then in the top right-hand corner, hit that little tab that says Join. And then listen to the end of today's episode for a sneak peek at today's new bonus episode. Hey, Small Town fam, it's Yardley. How are you guys? Where are you guys? I hope wherever you are, all is well. Today, we're going to take you behind the scenes of a hostage negotiation. The suspect has barricaded himself in an attic and is threatening to kill police if he can get a clear shot at them. This episode highlights one of the extraordinary aspects of being a detective, and that is setting aside all judgment of the person sitting in front of you, or in this case, barricading himself in an attic and threatening to kill you. Setting aside all of your feelings about that person so that you can stay safe, gather evidence, and ultimately get justice for the victims. New guest, retired Detective Constable Ron, is on the microphone today, and he gives us an up-close and very personal account of what it takes to talk someone off the ledge, so to speak, when the stakes couldn't be higher. This episode has everything you'll never hear on the evening news. Here is Deadlock. Hi there, I'm Yardley.
I'm Dan.
I'm Dave.
And I'm Paul.
And this is Small Town Dicks.
Dave and I are identical twins
and retired detectives from Small Town USA.
And I'm a veteran cold case investigator who helped catch the Golden State Killer using a revolutionary DNA tool.
Between the three of us, we've investigated thousands of crimes, from petty theft to sexual assault, child abuse to murder.
Each case we cover is told by the detective who investigated it, offering a rare, personal account of how they solved the crime.
Names, places, and certain details have been changed to protect the privacy of victims and their families.
And although we're aware that some of our listeners may be familiar with these cases, we ask you to please join us in continuing to protect the true identities of those involved
out of respect for what they've been through.
Thank you.
Today on Small Town Dicks, we have the usual suspects. We have Detective Dale.
Good morning, team.
Good morning, you. We have Detective Dave.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, sunshine. And we have the one and only Paul Holes.
Hey, hey, how's it going?
Hey, hey. Oh, for our listeners, it's just been a while since we all gathered. I miss my A-team. Sadly, we're, again, not all in the same geographical location, but I'll take the Zoom all day, any day. And, Small Town fam, we are so pleased to welcome a new guest to the podcast, retired Detective Constable Ron.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
We're so delighted that you're here with us today. It's always great to hear from new as well as returning guests. I think what's interesting, a lot of what all of y'all do in law enforcement is similar. There are so many commonalities, but each and every one of your journeys is entirely different. And we're grateful that you have agreed to come and tell us a little bit about what it has been like for you.
Well, thank you.
So, Ron, since this is your first time, we'd love to get a little thumbnail biography of your career in law enforcement before you retired.
Yeah, I started policing in 1984. I was fortunate. I was quite young when I got hired. I was 21 years old. And I like to think that my enthusiasm made up for my lack of experience. And I was fortunate to get hired in my hometown. No other police service would hire me. Turned out to be a very good move for me. You start off walking the beat, and I did a lot of beat walking, and you get to know people and get out of your shell, and you're forced to have interactions, that sort of thing. So get used to people staring at you when you're walking around in uniform carrying a gun, which is hard to get used to initially, you know, especially as a younger officer. But spent in total 20 years in patrol, but 15 years of that was on our tactical team. We refer to it as an emergency response team, like the SWAT team that you would have in the States as well. in the area I police too, it's a penitentiary town. So there's a lot of penitentiaries in the area. We have a lot of released prisoners or ex-inmates that stay in the area as well, and their families. So there's a lot of repeat customers.
I'm curious that you have multiple penitentiaries in your town. Does that seem unusual to you guys? I feel like a town can handle one penitentiary. That seems like enough, no?
I think it goes both ways. Like, you could have an area that has a workforce that all have, you know, training and certifications that have to do with this. And then you find an area that there's actually room to build multiple prisons. So to me, it makes sense to have them kind of all located in the same area. I'm guessing there's different security levels at each of these facilities.
Correct. There's different levels, maximum, minimum, medium security as well.
So you typically wouldn't have two like supermax prisons even in the same state. They spread those out. But if you've got different levels of, you know, community corrections to local supervision all the way up to, you know, real prison, then it makes sense to me to have them all in the same area.
Interesting. That makes good sense. Okay, Ron, so multiple prisons, repeat offenders, and a lot of people who get released, it seems, stay in the area as well.
They do. The families relocate, and there's a good support system for the families. So there are a lot of reasons for them to stay in the area. So it makes for an interesting mix. It's also a university town, so we have a nice mixture of persons to deal with.
Wow, you have it all. You really have it all.
And it's right on a lovely lake and lots of water. So yeah, I'm, again, very fortunate to get hired in this area too as well.
I love it. So Ron, please tell us how this case came to you.
At this point in my career, I was in our training branch. So involved in training officers, new officers, experienced officers. And I received a phone call saying we need a crisis negotiator. We have a subject we're trying to arrest, and he is barricaded himself in a townhouse in an area that police are quite familiar with. And because it's referred to as a barricaded subject, and evidence was that he had a gun as well, that we will not enter the residence. It will be negotiations. So that's part of the policy, part of the practice in Canada as well. So a fellow that was well known to me by the name of Tim had a outstanding warrant. Tim had a long history of drug dealing, was seen the last couple of years carrying guns, collecting drug debts, scaring off other drug dealers. And one of the charges in this particular case was extortion, which is not a common charge, but trying to extort drug money from other persons in the area. So the police were actively looking for him. And my understanding was that the street crime unit had received information that he was at this unit. And when the tactical team attended, the tenants came out of the townhouse and said, yes, Tim is in the residence and he does have a gun. So at that point, the tactical team contained the residence and negotiators were called out.
Did Tim know the residents who exited the house?
He did, actually. One of the ladies that lived in the residence was friends with his girlfriend. And I think he was using it to hide out. Wasn't really determined whether or not he forced his way in or was just using it as a temporary residence to hide because he couldn't go home knowing there was a warrant for him.
Ron, do you get the feeling that this is one of those situations where somebody became aware of Tim's presence at this townhouse and later sneaks a call to the police? Hey, I know you guys are looking for Tim. He's been at this house for the last hour and I just left. He's still there.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And that expression of honor among thieves, I've never seen that exist. Money is a motivator.
Well, and it's interesting that Tim develops some extortion charges because of who Tim is threatening with guns. In the drug and crime culture, it is very rare for other criminals to call in a crime and report a robbery or, you know, an intimidation or menacing with a gun because they go, well, what kind of interactions do you have with Tim? Well, I mean, he and I are drug dealers. So it just gives you an idea of Tim is probably believed when he threatens people so much so that they will say, I'm not going to worry about my drug dealing business. I need to call the police and get some protection.
Yeah, that's very true.
Ron, you said Tim was well known to you.
Yeah, I think I knew him when he was 10 or 11 and used to talk to each other on a first name basis. And then when he got older, got into the drug culture and, fairly rough upbringing, but not the worst. But he just decided to go in that direction, I guess.
And how old is Tim when you encounter him in this barricaded house situation?
He is 37 years old at this point, and so he's quite experienced in the criminal activity.
And what was he doing as a 10 or 11-year-old? Were you encountering him at that time as a police officer or because you both lived in the same town?
More, I worked in that area. So I would, if there were a bunch of kids in that area shooting, baskets or something, basketball, I'd pop out of the cruiser, talk to them, shoot a couple of baskets with them. He'd be one of those persons, right? Or if it's a road hockey in Canada, we love hockey. If there's a road hockey game or something, I'd pop out of the cruiser and grab a stick or something. Just trying to make that personal connection, right? Like, okay, we're not all bad. I know that a lot of youth in that area, once they hit a certain age, they stop calling you police or, in my case, Ron, and start referring to us as pigs. And it's like, well, that's a learned behavior. So I'm trying to at least delay that portion of it, build some sort of communication.
Interesting.
Yeah. In this case, not always successful.
And when did Tim begin his criminal career?
He was still a youth. And I know that there was a lot of thefts in there, some robberies, low-end robberies, like using force to obtain something. And he had been in and out of the prison system, nothing too serious. I don't think he did penitentiary time here. A sentence beyond 2 years, you do penitentiary time in Canada. I don't think he had been to the penitentiary yet, but in and out of the jail system, the court system, providing, lots of jobs for police and lawyers and courts and
right,
that sort of thing.
Frequent flyer.
Frequent flyer, absolutely.
So on this day, Tim has now sort of taken things, he's really leveled up. He's taking it up a notch by barricading himself in this townhouse with a deadly weapon. And you all now need to deal with this.
Correct. Yeah, it's a lovely summer day and it's warm out. It's not raining. It's in a populated area. So a lot of townhouses, a lot of persons around. So once the police are there, it does draw a crowd for sure. There's a number of police officers containing the area, as well as closing off the streets in the area. I think it started at about noon, and I arrived at about 1 p.m. and spoke to the incident commander, who's in charge of the scene, makes all the decisions. I'm not sure if it works the same way in the States, but the nice part as a negotiator, I make no decisions. I put all the decisions on the incident commander.
Same with us.
Okay.
So where do you begin with Tim? How does the communication start?
There's a bit of a slow start, but because it wasn't his residence and because there wasn't extenuating circumstances where the police had to force the door open because there was containment, he couldn't go anywhere. There was some risk of him going up in the attic or punching out some walls. There were 7 different townhouses attached where he could have had access to other townhouses. So there was a lot of police containing, making sure, had to evacuate all the other residents as well. So once the tactical team was advised, there was a warrant in effect. So a Feeney warrant, which is a warrant to enter. And there's also an arrest warrant. So 2 different warrants that now it becomes a lawful entry. There's tactical breach and delay. You breach the door and they called out. There was no response. They threw in eyeballs, remote cameras, and still no response.
I'm like, eyeballs?
Yeah.
These SWAT teams have really cool tools, like throw robots that you can throw that can climb stairs and land, like 30 feet off a building, they land and they just drive off and go wherever you want. Really great tools.
One of the more fun aspects of being on a tactical team is that you get to do the fun stuff. So you get to arrest people and just throw in a statement and then walk away. Whereas you detectives have to do all the paperwork.
Right. So your tactics to breach and, open things up, let him know, hey, we're not going away. Is that kind of a standard protocol that your team and your experience you went through that, hey, we're going to try this first. We're going to let it cook for however long, and then we're going to go to tactic number two. Specific to this situation, what was the strategy?
So they threw in the eyeballs, which would give them a good view of the interior as much as they could. Called out, there was nothing. K9 attended at the scene. And if you've ever had the luxury of working with K9, they are just an invaluable tool.
Dan was a K9 cop.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So, well, hats off. Hats off to K9 officers, because it's just so invaluable. Total side note, but I did put on a bite suit once, and it was the most intimidating experience I've ever had.
I've been bit probably 1,000 times by dogs.
Oh,
yeah. Dan, what's the consideration for a canine officer in this situation? You know, you've got an armed subject. There are limitations, I know, but I'll let you walk us through it.
Well, obviously, you want to know the floor plan of this house.
Yes.
Where are routes of egress? How much real estate can we buy with our eyes first? You guys throw eyeballs in there and we can buy some real estate there. And then you slowly inch your way through. And I'm sure a lot of departments are like this, but I would never send my dog on a suicide mission.
No.
So, you know, if Tim is in a back bedroom and we know he's armed, I'm not going to send my dog in after Tim. And I could have a sergeant command me to send my dog, and I could tell my sergeant, nope, not doing it. There were no repercussions for me. I got to control that whole scene when it came to the canine stuff. So yeah, I think the main consideration here is Tim's got a gun and we might use the dog to search, but I'm not going to just send my dog off leash and have him seek and destroy. It's a suicide mission. And I'll say this, sometimes I could give my dog Fido a command to bark, and sometimes that was enough to get people to give up.
That's very true. It has worked in the past, actually, as well. But in this particular case, unfortunately, it didn't. What we knew about Tim is that he was good at hiding. In the past, he was found hiding in piles of laundry. Another time, he was hiding in the basement behind a dresser, but he had cut out portions of the dresser, so the drawers still worked, but he was hiding in that little cavity of the dresser, which was pushed up against the wall.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So are you saying, has the verbal communication ceased and now you all have gone into the house to try to apprehend Tim?
Yep. So at this point, the tactical team has their foot in the door. They have the living room area, and they were able to clear that with the dog calling out and using lights and cameras, that sort of thing. I don't know how long it took for them to clear the main floor of the basement, but then not found. Tim is still in there for sure because he couldn't have escaped. And that's when they proceeded upstairs. And at the very top of the stairs, before you enter the bedroom or bathrooms, there's an attic hatch. And the officers noticed insulation, little pieces of insulation on the carpet above the hatch. So it doesn't necessarily at this point mean he's there. You still have to clear the rest of the unit, which they did. And once they safely removed the sliding hatch, they called out. And at that point, Tim starts yelling to them, saying, if you show your head, I'm going to shoot you. Show your head and I will shoot you. I have a gun. I'm not afraid to use it.
So Tim is saying to the officers, if you pop your head up into this attic, I'm going to shoot you.
Absolutely.
Have you arrived on scene by this point? And at what point do you start doing the Jedi Master negotiation stuff?
Yeah, I have arrived and we get information that contact was made. The other piece of the puzzle is that in the past, Tim has been violent towards police. So he's also hesitant to give up peacefully because he's, you know, afraid of retribution or something, which wouldn't have happened. But his experience is not positive because he's always been assaulted towards police during the arrest. So appropriate force is, you know, used in that case. So once they establish containment where he is, then we try to establish communication. So go through a process of trying to lock down phones, that sort of thing, but that's not entirely successful. But eventually, a throw phone is placed up in the attic.
And what's that? What's a throw phone?
So it is a phone that will ring directly to the command post as well. So the only persons that can talk are the two people at either end. The communication can be heard in the command post, so the incident commander can hear the negotiations as well as others in the command post. But the only person talking would be myself. My secondary negotiator would be there listening, passing notes, that sort of thing. But I'm the only one communicating at that point.
So just you and Tim have basically access to this line.
Exactly. And you only throw in so much throw phone, then you can kind of measure, okay, there's 8 feet of cord, so he has to be 8 feet of the entrance.
Oh, so the phone is connected to a cord. It really is like a really sophisticated two cups with a string.
good analogy. Absolutely. Yeah. A very strong covered metal sort of casing wire. It's pretty much bomb proof in the Pelican case.
Hey, Ron, this attic that Tim is in, is this a finished attic? He can move around freely, or is he balancing on the rafters?
He's balancing on the rafters and enjoying the pink insulation. And it's August, so he's cooking. He's cooking for sure. And when they first initially threw the phone to Tim, he threw it back thinking he was going to get shocked by picking up the phone. It's in a case. He had to open the case and it was ringing. It would ring constantly. So a ringing telephone is, you know, very irritating. He was encouraged by the tactile team that nothing's going to happen until you pick up the phone. And eventually the second time he finally picked up the phone. So the initial conversation with him is basically him telling me repeatedly to fuck off. And that's how the conversation starts. And he kept repeating that in this higher pitched voice. And I know that this is the case for all of you, but you develop a bit of a interesting sense of humor in policing. So it was hard not to laugh because he so reminded me of Joe Pesci, that high pitched swearing type voice.
That's funny and so specific that Tim sounds like Joe Pesci.
Yep.
So are you back at the command post on the other line of this wired throw phone?
I am back in the command post, and Tim is in the attic with the throw phone. And the nice part about having a direct line is that there's no radio frequency interruptions, and it's a very clear communication. But it was difficult because he was encouraged by about 200, I'll call them fans, tenants in the area that were yelling to him, Tim, hang in there, the police are doing this.
So you're saying outside of the townhouse, there's a gaggle of people encouraging Tim to keep doing what he's doing.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a field and a fire lane. And it was a warm summer night. So because it was dragging on, the fans, the persons watching, spectators, brought out lawn chairs, ordered pizza, and were drinking beer.
Shut up.
Yeah, when I popped out of the command post at one point, it's like, I think there's about 200 people.
Oh, my God. And how long are you, Ron, on the phone with Tim before he decides he's too hot sitting in this attic and he's going to come out? Or does that happen?
I start at about 7 p.m. for negotiations with him, and it ends sometime around midnight before he actually comes out. The upside was by that point, some of the crowd had dispersed and he was getting less encouragement. But it did take a long time. Part of it, I think, is saving face. But the other piece is he did not want to go back to jail. But he was going to jail for sure.
Ron, do you recall how many little short phone calls you actually had with Tim? Like, he would give you a tidbit of information and say, fuck you, and hang up.
I wouldn't be surprised if there was around 30 short phone calls, just the constant ringing, slamming the phone down, or F-bombs.
Your conversation with Tim starts with a bunch of FUs, a volley of FUs to you. At some point, he changes his demeanor, and I'm sure that had a lot to do with the way you were speaking to him. Can you kind of run us through this progression of your negotiation?
Yeah. Tim did not recognize me or know who I was. You know, there's no recollection of, you know, me dealing with him when he was a youth, but that would probably worked out for the better, I think. But he kept demanding something to drink. I might go into a seizure. And I said, well, what does that mean? Are you a diabetic? No, just it's so hot up here. I need something to drink. And I went into, I said, I understand you have a gun. Are you familiar with guns? I don't want to see you hurt yourself. I'm trying to extract information, what sort of gun that he has. And he wouldn't disclose much other than he said it was a Desert Eagle.
The guys are all sort of nodding and cocking their heads. What does a Desert Eagle mean?
It's a hand cannon.
It's a large caliber gun.
50 caliber. It puts big holes in people.
I've held one. I've never shot one. It is heavy. It is an impractical handgun. And it's very unusual for somebody on the street to have a Desert Eagle.
Mm-hmm. So whether he had it, I don't know. But there was indication from the tenants that had left that he had a handgun. So again, all the precautions are taken. Tim kept saying that if you don't give me some of the drink, I'm going to shoot myself, which again, we have to do everything possible to prevent that as well. What made it difficult initially too for me was the incident commander did not want to give him a bottle of water without some exchange. Eventually, I was able to talk the incident commander into allowing that without exchange for anything. And it actually went a long ways to building rapport. And it opened up a line of communication to him. And again, keep it in mind, I don't respect this individual. I don't even like this individual, but that's not a bearing in this case at all. My goal is to have Tim come out peacefully without incident.
Ron, in my experience with negotiations, it's this huge chess game, and it's really, really odd when you're in this. And I just was hoping you could speak to what was the pattern with Tim on these series of phone calls over hours. I imagine it's like most negotiations go.
Yeah, it was a lot of hangups, a lot of, you know, FUs, but initially, get me a drink of water. I want to talk to my girlfriend, this sort of thing. So he's making demands, but every time I called and he picked up, it would be just a little bit longer conversation. So it was starting, you know, and regardless of what he says to me, you know, I'm not going to be offended. You know, what does that matter? Once Tim started making demands, I thought, okay, so this is good. Part of it is I'm based on my training that if he wants water, it means that he doesn't want to harm himself. Like, okay, that goes a long ways. One of the big things he wanted to do was talk to his girlfriend, Michelle. And he kept talking, well, my body is sore, but he's lying on rafters, right? So he's not super comfortable at this point. Tim doesn't want to go back to jail. He asked me what the charges were. I did not tell him that it was extortion. That sounded a little too heavy to me, and I didn't really have the details. Turns out probably I should have because he realized a breach charge. There's no way the cops are all here for just a breach charge or something more.
And the breach charges, I'm holed up in this house.
You're released on bail, so a breach of a bail.
It's like a violation of release agreement.
Yes. So it was more than just that. And he was right. So I said, well, there are weapon charges. One thing we were taught is if you do tell a lie, you have to maintain that lie. So I tried not to do any of that. It's just too difficult to remember it during the course of the conversation. You know, and Tim is sober at this point. I don't know if he had ingested drugs prior to going up to the attic. I suspect he probably had. But given the length of time, I think that whatever was in his system was probably wore out. That probably helped the communication portion of it too as well. The incident commander said, yeah, we'll let him talk to his girlfriend before he goes to jail. So I was able to give Tim that. So I want to talk to my brother. Tim said it was his best friend. I said, well, I can't make that promise until I run it by my boss, which is a typical line, and the boss being the incident commander. So I don't become the bad guy. My boss does, right? Comments like, well, your boss is a, you know, asshole. It's like, well, you know.
Sure. Ron, is there anything in the course of negotiation that you absolutely would not give the barricaded subject?
Good question. I went on a course and it was this negotiator trainer that was just renowned national. And he said, what can you never offer someone that you're negotiating with? And the answer is essentially nothing. He says, would you not give them cocaine in order to get two hostages back? It's like, yeah, I probably would. If it was an incident with hostages, then pretty much anything's on the table as far as what you will give in order to get. So partway through the incident, Tim's brother, and his brother was there the whole time, outside somewhere.
Was Tim's brother also a criminal?
He was, and I've had dealings with his brother in the past as well. Tim's brother was a wannabe musician. He had a guitar. He thought he could sing. He created some sort of recording, and he convinced the detectives to give Tim the CD that he made of his own music. to convince Tim to come out. So lessons learned and debriefing, the tactical team inside played the recording and shut it off very quickly because it was basically, and then I'll quote some lyrics here, but basically it was fuck the police on a guitar.
Oh, and, great.
Yeah, so lessons learned, pre-listen to any recordings before they're set. But keep it in mind, you know, the officers have been there for about 9 hours and there's some fatigue happening for sure. And trying to end it as quickly as possible. And that just didn't seem to help. As it got later, one of the things that we were taught was, well, develop a rapport if you can with forensic psychiatrist to bounce ideas off. But also, should they commit self-harm, that have we done everything possible? So I had developed a connection with a forensic psychiatrist in the area who dealt with persons in the penitentiary. And I was able to call him, and not only did he offer advice, he attended the scene. And a little different, but he actually sat in the negotiator cell with me and had a set of earphones. And the incident commander was fine with that. He doesn't have a mic, he doesn't speak, but he can listen to the conversations.
The psychiatrist can't communicate with Tim directly.
Can't communicate directly. Should it ever go to an inquest, I think that would be beneficial, that we do everything possible to prevent self-harm, right? Because that's the only way Tim was going to get heard at that point. And the forensic psychiatrist came up with a really good idea and said, tell Tim that the insulation is toxic. That's a very good idea. And so called him back and I said, Tim, I have a medical doctor, which a forensic psychiatrist is here sitting with me. And he tells me that the insulation is toxic and it could have long-term effects. Tim had a young son, so I was able to say, you know, you need to be there for your son. He won't be in jail very long. And his girlfriend, he had a girlfriend of a month. He said he loved her, you know, so he was able to talk about that. But when Tim said, well, yeah, I am kind of itchy and I'm getting red welts, I was able to say, well, that's the first sign of it becoming toxic. Let me think about it. He hung up. After he hung up, I asked the forensic psychiatrist, is the insulation toxic? And his response was, I have no idea. But it did work. It did work, right? So of course, you know, lying in insulation, you're going to be itchy. You're going to get some sort of skin reaction. So that was very helpful. He didn't think that Tim would do any self-harm based on the conversation he was hearing, which was good. And that was about, well, 9 o'clock at night. And the forensic psychiatrist, to his credit, after working all day, stayed the whole time. He had trained us a little bit too as well, howing to deal with certain persons, schizophrenic persons, that sort of thing. So he was a very good resource for us. Around this time when Tim was getting tired, he'd be crying one minute, wanting to talk to his girlfriend, other times getting mad, you know, start dropping the F-bombs. But there was constant communication, frequent phone calls at this point, just frequent phone calls. A bit of an aside, but our air conditioning wasn't working, so I was probably drinking too much water, which also meant that I had to use a bathroom. Our bathroom in the command post wasn't working, so a neighbor's house next door that we had tapped into their phone system initially to try to get that connection working, they were friendly, you know, a little apprehensive about police, but they were friendly. They were helpful. They allowed me to use their washroom. So when I came out of the washroom, the mother is there and she has this parking ticket in her hand. And she says, is there any chance at all that you can take care of this parking ticket?
Shut up. Wow.
Yeah. So I said, yeah, that sounds fair. So when I got back to the command post, I just gave it to my incident commander and smiled. And I said, I told her that you would take care of this.
Oh my God. It's not enough that you're trying to protect her from this guy who has a deadly weapon and God knows what he'll do. No, please fix my parking ticket.
Well, I did want to reuse the washroom if necessary down the road. So I'm sure it got paid. I don't know by whom, not me. You find humor where you can sometimes.
So what's the final push, do you think, that gets Tim out of the attic? And then I'm assuming you take him into custody, you take him down to the station. How does all that go?
Yeah, the final push is I promised him that I would ensure he got a can of Coke, that he would be able to smoke some cigarettes and talk to his girlfriend before he got taken. I also said, you're not going to the station yet. You have to go to the hospital. We have to take you to the hospital, which it was the truth. You know, one, just to check his well-being, and two, for mental health purposes. But that was a bit of a selling point as well. And I think his brother had brought down other clothes for him or something. But it still took a while. When Tim eventually came down, and we don't use the word giving up, right? It's a coming out plan, because giving up is failing on his end of it. So the coming out plan was, you have to hang down from the rafters with your arms. I'll help you down. You'll be handcuffed in behind and searched. And he says, well, I want my drink right away. It's like, not going to happen, Tim. Like, you're going to be searched first, officer safety, that sort of thing.
Tim wants another bottle of water, is what you're saying.
Tim wants another bottle of water. He wants to have the Coke and the smokes up in the attic. Not going to give him any flammables. And, you know, the pull of, and I'm sure that the rest of the detectives found this helpful, that a lot of the accused that we deal with are smokers, and you can use that tool. The pull of the nicotine is a strong draw.
It works even better than iPads with teenagers.
What? That's impossible.
I always kept a pack of smokes in my, you know, briefcase or whatever I carried with me too, as well, for that purpose. When Tim eventually came down, his girlfriend was there the whole time too, the incident commander. I was in eyesight of him, and any requests that he asked for, he gave me the thumbs up so I could say, yes, you're going to have the cigarettes. Yes, you're going to have the cup of coffee. Yes, after being searched, you'll be handcuffed in the front so you can have your can of Coke. Yes, you can talk to your girlfriend at the scene. At this point, it was around midnight. And after Tim was searched, I walked to where he was. He was sitting on the front stoop, and girlfriend was there. He was handcuffed. He was drinking his pop. He was smoking his cigarettes, which I ensured that he got. I wanted to make sure, you know, promises, that sort of thing. And I actually thanked him for coming out and being cooperative and ending the incident peacefully. The forensic psychiatrist came with me, actually wanted to meet the individual as well. Didn't say anything to him, but just part of his, I guess, reward to see the end of the incident too as well. The question usually comes up, well, why did you ensure that you carried out on the promises? And interesting enough, less than 2 years later, very similar incident happened with Tim as well. And that one only lasted about an hour. But again, the officers were able to say, look, we've never lied to you. We've given you all your promises. Same sort of thing happened where we'll give you a, you know, can of Coke and some smokes or that sort of thing. And again, not a good human being in that case, but still it's important, right, to keep those lines of communication open. This makes the job easier.
Absolutely.
You have to play the long game with this. What I see going wrong with some officers is they take the job personally and they're not able to separate. We want a quick, peaceful resolution to this. I don't have to respect this suspect. This isn't personal either. So why do I let my personal feelings get in the way of a successful resolution? It's not about the negotiator. It's not about the officer. It's about this person in this certain headspace, thinking about all the consequences of what they're going to have to answer to once they're put in handcuffs, that cops that lose sight of that tend to not do very well in investigations. They tend to not do very well in interviews and interrogations because they can't get past themselves. And you keeping the big picture in mind with Tim and this negotiation, realizing and understanding the likelihood of Tim and I having an interaction in the future is probably pretty good, given his behaviors when he's free. So there's no use in trying to claim victory on this one negotiation and, ha-ha, I lied to you, and we're not going to give you any of that. What purpose does that serve? It just means the next time Tim barricades himself, it's going to be a huge headache for everybody.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, that, as it turned out, less than 2 years later. Actually, they called me for that one, but I was on my way for a training course at the police college, and they referred to it as the sequel.
Oh, God.
Tell Tim the mattress he's sitting on is poison.
So, Ron, what was Tim ultimately charged with once you get him in handcuffs out of this barricaded subject situation?
So some of the charges, I found out that he was charged with utter threats to police, so threatening to kill the police, mischief not exceeding $5,000, which is damaging the police equipment, the camera, the breach of probation charge, robbery, the robbery extortion charges, extortion on top of that, and forcible confinement, which prior to that, I think it was about 2 weeks prior, Tim had forced his way into another unit demanding drug payment for drugs that he had sold this couple. But Tim's sentence in total was 19 months for everything. So yeah, we have a bit of a lenient system at times in my country. 19 months later is about when Tim barricaded himself again.
Ron, even though this negotiation with Tim went really remarkably well, even though it was hours and hours, is there anything, as you reflected on it, that you would have done differently?
Absolutely. Some of the lessons learned for us in this case is they asked me where I wanted the command post. Well, I had the command post way too close to the crisis point. It should have been backed away, so I wasn't in direct view of the 200 people having a party in the background, because I could hear them as well. At one point, I could hear Tim yelling through the attic to them. So that's how loud he was yelling. Like, he'd crawled up near the vents and was yelling back to them. So that was too close. There were a few other lessons learned from this one as well, but overall, successful because it ended without incident.
Yeah, no cops hurt. Suspect is uninjured. Perfect.
Absolutely.
And Ron, you said earlier that you never actually saw the gun, this giant Desert Eagle that Tim had. Does that mean it was never recovered?
Yeah. No gun or bullet was ever found. But I do think Tim had one, and I think he was able to somehow drop it down through an opening, which maybe it'd end up somewhere between the walls of the townhouse as well. But yeah, we never did find that.
So Ron, how do you, after 5 hours of really high pressure negotiation and it ends around midnight, how do you go home and decompress so that you can go to sleep? What do you do? Are you up for hours?
Yeah, great question. And absolutely, I'm up for hours. You know, I'm in need of a beverage and to talk to somebody, but nobody is up when I get home.
Oh.
And all the other officers had worked days, so they were not interested. So where I live, it's fairly quiet, which is nice. I was able to grab a beverage, go for a walk and think about the incident, perhaps things I could have done better, but just unwind, because there's no point for me at that point going straight to bed.
Right.
Broken sleep, had to be back at work the next day at 8 o'clock in the morning. So it wasn't a whole lot of sleep there, but we were doing some training. So I was the only one working that day in the training branch. So I had to be in for eight.
God, it's so intricate. So many things to think about.
Ron, it strikes me, I know you've gone through training and you've got your years of experience in law enforcement, but just sitting on this side, listening to you, you have the perfect personality to be a negotiator. You're sensitive, you're empathetic, you know, you have to bond with people you don't care for, you know, you've had prior interactions with. And, you know, I think the success in this case has a lot to do with you and how you kind of approach life and your career. So great job.
Thank you, Paul.
Well said. Thank you so much for sharing that with us today.
You're very welcome, Yardley.
Great resolution, Ron. Textbook work right there.
Great job, Ron.
Thank you.
Now for a sneak peek at today's new bonus episode. I remember getting in trouble because we were so cold that night and we were so punch drunk that we kept laughing and our director just had it with us. We were like wayward children, errant children, not behaving.
Who's the most disruptive on that set?
Probably me. Actually. To listen to today's bonus episode and access hundreds more, go to smalltowndicks.com/superfam and hit that little join button. Small Town Dicks was created by Detectives Dan and Dave. The podcast is produced by Jessica Halstead and me, Yardley Smith. Our senior editor is Soren Bajan, and our editors are Christina Bracamontes and Aaron Phelps. Our associate producers are The Real Nick Smitty and Aaron Gaynor. Gary Scott is our executive producer, and Logan Heftel is our production manager. Our books are cooked and cats wrangled by Ben Cornwell. And our social media maven is Monica Scott. It would make our day if you became a member of our small town fam by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at Small Town Dicks. We love hearing from you. Oh, our groovy theme song was composed by John Forrest. Also, if you'd like to support the making of this podcast, go to smalltowndicks.com/superfam and hit that little join button. There, for a small subscription fee, you'll find exclusive content you can't get anywhere else. The transcripts of this podcast are thanks to SpeechDocs, and they can be found on our website, smalltowndicks.com. Thank you, SpeechDocs, for this wonderful service. Small Town Dicks is an Audio 99 production. Small Town fam, thanks for listening. Nobody is better than you.